This podcast is brought to you by Australia's LGBTQIA+ community media organisation, Joy. Keep Joy on air by becoming a member, a subscriber, or donate. Head to joy.org.au. Joy, a diverse sound for a diverse community.
This Joycast is a free service brought to you by Joy 94.9. Support Joy 94.9 by becoming a member at joy.org.au.
Welcome to Undriven on Joy 94.9, today with Mark, Sam and myself, Hugh. On today's show, we have Robert, who is an ex-English teacher, part owner of the Hulu Cafe in Bali and author of two books with a third on the way. Robert will talk about being gay even though he did not want to be, living in Bali and why he decided to write two books, one of which is based on his life experiences. As usual, another interesting chat coming up here on Driven today, so please stay with us for the next hour on Joy 94.9. Joy 94.9, this is Driven with Hugh, Sam and Mark. And our guest today is Robert King, who's an ex-English teacher, was ex-part owner of Hulu Cafe in Bali, and is the author of two books as well. Now, welcome to the show, Robert.
Good. Thanks for having me.
That's fine. Now, Robert, as usual, our guests always pick the music for the show. Tell us what the music was that we just played.
That was a piece called Meditation by a French composer called Massenet. And the reason I picked it, basically, is that I like violins, particularly mm-hmm. that sort of yearning sound.
Okay.
And I think I'll have it played at my funeral.
Really?
Yeah.
Oh, okay.
Yes, yeah, well, beautiful song.
People pay for their funerals before it, so why can't you pick the music? That's what. Now, Robert, you've come along today because you are the author of two very good books I've read as well. And just for the listener, we actually are giving away a copy of each book. One is The Wheeler Sign and one is called Selected Works. Now, we're not giving them away just now, but halfway through the show, we'll give them away. And we've actually got two lots to give away today. So stay tuned, and we will be giving away these books to two lucky people who phone up. Now, Robert, before we start talking about your books, let's start talking about you, where you were brought up.
Before I sort of answer that question, I think what I'd like to do is premise it by saying that there was an author called James Baldwin mm-hmm. who talked about the past as another country.
Right.
He's a bit out of favour at the moment, but a very good author. And I think the logical extension of that is basically when we talk about the past, I tend to think about me as a child as somebody else.
Oh, okay.
I feel fairly detached from that person, and that's actually one of the premises in the one of the books, which we'll talk about later too.
Yes, yes.
But anyway, to answer your question, I was raised and born in Balan, which is a small town between Ballarat and Melbourne.
Mm.
I was the youngest of five, but by the time I was six, all of my siblings had left home and got married. So I was basically brought up as an only child, I guess, with elderly parents.
Right.
My father was an invalid pensioner and my mother didn't work. So I lived in that small country town right up until I was about 17.
Right. Now, you told me one interesting thing was that at a very early age, I think you said around about six, you began to understand what sex was about.
I think all kids know what sex is about from a very early age. I think the problem is they're not aware of the connotations of it, but they certainly know what it feels like. And I think from an early age, I had experiences which I quite liked. But to me, if you'd mentioned anything about being gay or being, you know, doing something that was wrong, I'd just look at you blankly because I wouldn't even understand what you were talking about.
Yeah.
So, yeah, there was a fair amount of sex going on in the country town, I have to say, in the early days.
You're trying to say there's not much else to do?
Probably. Yeah, I guess so.
Was it just like school friends or just people you'd met in the community, or was it
just friends from the town? We used to do it a lot. I mean, nothing heavy. I'm not talking about that. It was just mostly experimentation, you know.
Yeah.
Doctors and nurses.
Doctors and nurses, all that sort of games, yeah. That sort of stuff.
Now, you told me that at 17, you fell in love with your best friend.
Yeah. I think before that, I also felt that I was a bit different, but I didn't know why. Mm. There was a sort of a feeling that I needed somebody or I wanted something, but I couldn't express it, you know, when I was young. The sex part of it, I mean, I didn't sort of, as I said, that didn't indicate to me anything, but it was, I suppose, when emotions came into it.
Mm.
And I had a fairly obsessive relationship with my best friend when I was 17, and that went on for a couple of years. And
was he aware?
I don't know what he was aware of, because we never expressed it, but we spent a lot of time together.
Mm.
But it was not sexual, except that, you know, if he wasn't at school, I used to ring him up and say, where were you, and all that sort of stuff, and, mm-hmm. you know. But anyway, that ended fairly traumatically, because at 17, I realised that this is somewhere I didn't want to go.
Mm. You actually went for therapy, didn't you?
That was a bit later on, yes, when I was in my early 20s, because once I realised what it meant to be gay, I didn't want to have a bar of it. In fact, I saw it as a long tunnel, and I didn't know what was down the end of that tunnel. So when I moved down to Melbourne, I went to a doctor first in Ballarat and just told him that I had these feelings, and he gave me a letter to go to the Royal Psychiatric Hospital in Royal Park.
Because in those days it was considered a disease of sorts.
Yeah, well, I think right up till the early 70s, I mean, the psychologists still thought it was something that could be cured.
Mm.
And I went through aversion therapy, which is basically having electrodes strapped onto your wrists, and you're nice. Supposed to look at photos of men and boys and feel all erotic about it, and then you get electric shock.
Yeah.
And that was supposed to stop you.
Right.
Suppress how you were feeling. Mm.
And that's something you voluntarily did for therapy, or?
Yes, I did, because I didn't, as I said, I didn't want to be gay. I was pretty desperate at that stage to find a cure or to find a way out of this, because I didn't want to go down that path. And I would try anything, you know, not to do it. When this psychologist spoke to me, he also used to take a lot of notes, I remember, heaps of notes.
Mm-hmm.
And one of the things he showed me is a lot of people aren't familiar with what's called the Rorschach ink blot tests.
Mm-hmm.
And there are a series of ink blots, and you're supposed to be able to read into it all sorts of things, and the psychologist is supposed to be able to interpret from the ink blot whether you're gay or not simply by the sign.
Yeah.
And hence one of my books is called The Wheeler Sign, because that was actually one of the signs of homosexuality.
Oh. Talking about the Wheeler Sign, you've actually got some notes from your therapy, didn't you?
Yeah, much later I decided that I'd apply for my case file from the Royal Psychiatric Hospital. So I did, and I got notes sent to me from, you know, Freedom of Information, which you can do.
Mm.
And I had a look at those case notes. But again, reading them, I didn't feel any connection with that person. I thought, that's not me, that's not somebody else.
So, Robert, would you like to tell us what that track is?
That's a song called September Song, sung by Nat King Cole. It was written by Kurt Vile, and it's one of those songs, particularly at this stage of my life, it seems to be a metaphor for where we are in the sort of last few months of our, well, not the last few months, but the autumn of our existence. And I think it's about mortality, basically. And that's why I actually liked the song very much.
Mm-hmm. Cool.
Now, before we actually played your music, we were talking about your therapy that you were going through, but part of your own therapy was as well, you got married, didn't you?
Yeah, I don't know if I'd call it therapy. Yeah. I don't want to give the impression I got married to escape being gay. Yeah. I actually love the person I got married to. And the idea of getting married was terrific. For the first 5 years, it was great. We did a lot of wonderful things, and then I suppose the best thing to come out of it was two children.
Mm.
And I think to go through a marriage, to have two children, is pretty good. Mm. I think I told my ex-wife that I thought I was bisexual, because I certainly didn't want to get into the marriage without being honest about, you know, where I was at. But that's about all I could say to her. And then...
So was this after the therapy and it sort of cured you?
After the therapy, in between, I decided that the only thing that would work would be willpower. Mm-hmm. And so, you know, that's what I tried to do.
Right.
And anyway, once I got married... my ex-wife questioned me for the next 2 years about, and I couldn't say anything because all I could say is, look, I don't know what would happen, you know, if I get into a situation with a guy. So that's what it was all about.
But you actually joined GAMA, which is for gay married men?
Yeah, GAMA still exists. It's called the Gay and Married Men's Association.
Right.
Yeah, that was after the marriage broke down.
Okay.
And I have to say, the marriage didn't break down because I was gay. It broke down for a number of reasons. Mm. But anyway, GAMA is in Melbourne still. And when I joined that, I think that was fantastic because I thought I was the only gay married man in the world.
Yeah.
And when you go to a place like GAMA, you suddenly realise that there's a lot of them around. Yeah. And they were a great support group for me, and they sort of helped out, and I made quite a few friends through GAMA.
One thing I was thinking as well about when you explained that, you know, your feelings towards being gay at 17 and how you felt towards that was, I suppose I was thinking that, do you think that it would be different now if you were at 17 in this kind of era where people are much more open and it seems less, you know, different?
I think it depends on how much exposure you have. Mm. I mean, the other factor was I came from a small country town.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
There was nothing you could read, nobody you could talk to. I didn't know any gay people. So I still think people who live in those sort of situations find it difficult. But certainly being from the older generation, yeah, I think so. I think it's much easier these days when you've got so much more information and more sort of support groups to do it.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Let's talk a little bit about one of your books, The Wheeler Sign. Now, I read this last Sunday, as I told you off air. I sat all afternoon just reading this book, and I honestly couldn't put it down. I had to finish this book. Tell us a little bit about this book, because it's really your life experiences, isn't it?
I think the first book you write usually is. You've got to get rid of all that autobiographical stuff, and then you can sort of, you know, settle on other things. But, yeah, there's a lot of my life in that book.
Mm.
I think the interesting thing about The Wheeler Sign too is the way it's structured. When I started this program, I talked to you about the past being another country and people being different. And so the book's divided into three parts: the boy's story, your story, and my story. And when I write about the boy, I'm of course writing about myself as a boy, but also as somebody who's totally different, totally detached. And I wrote that in the third person. Then the second section is in the second person, and then the third section is in the first person. So what I tried to capture was that sort of integration of the three stories, so that by the time you get to the end of the book, I'm talking about myself as an integrated person. And it's that sort of journey. I didn't just want to write another coming out book. So I wanted to do, you know, a bit differently.
The travelling that you mentioned in this book, did you actually do all the travelling?
Yes, I did. Yes, yeah. Yes.
Because it's quite interesting, the things you did when you were travelling.
Oh, yeah. Yes. The book moves from a small town to larger city and then out into the world. So that sort of mirrors, you know, the journey as well. So when I went overseas, it was like I'd already separated. I was on my own. So I came to the realisation then that I had to find out. That was the only only way I could find out if I was gay, is to actually do it.
Mm.
So, and I think
you succeeded in your travels.
you confirmed, did you?
I learned a lot about, especially about myself.
Yeah.
And myself in different situations.
Mm.
You know, somewhere along the line, I learned that I like younger guys.
All right.
And how did you get to that decision of okay, I need to get out there and start experiencing to see if it is true. Like, were you still in Melbourne or small country town still then? Or
No, I'd already gone to Melbourne, and I think having been to Gamma, which started to sort of open up my horizons a bit, mm-hmm. and then I made a pact with myself. I said, look, right, whatever comes along, I'm going to say yes, mm-hmm. and we'll see what happens. Like right. within safe boundaries, yeah, of course, but you know.
Now, you talked about your diary in this book as well.
Mm.
How much of the diary is actually in there, and how much did you keep out?
The diary's pretty accurate.
Yeah?
Yeah. I went through another obsessive relationship, which is expressed in the diary.
It is, yeah.
Yeah. It was with a person who actually I shared a house with at the time. And it was at a time when I'd just come out and I was trying to find out a lot about myself. And this young man happened to come into my life at the time. So I wrote about the relationship that we had.
It was interesting how it progressed and the ups and downs and everything. But and I got the feeling that you were madly in love with this person, but this person was a little bit in love with you. Is that right?
Speaking for him, I would probably say he would never use that word.
He wouldn't use that word.
No, he identified as very strictly masculine and heterosexual.
Mm.
And it was only later on that he sort of started to sort of have physical sort of feelings.
Mm.
I don't know if it was ever emotional on his side.
I got the feeling it was.
Yeah.
Maybe it's just the way you
Maybe you're
it.
Right. I don't know. Maybe I wanted it to be.
Maybe you wanted it to be. Yeah. Do you still see that person?
No.
No?
No. He had rather a sad ending, unfortunately.
Oh.
He became bipolar
right.
later on, and I broke off all relationships with him because basically I was pretty scared of him because I wasn't sure what he would do, and I don't know what he's doing now.
Right.
But I have to say that that relationship went on for 16 years.
Wow.
Really?
Yes.
It's a long time.
Mm.
Long time.
So the characters in the book, are they all real characters or is there some fiction in there?
I think writing's a combination of what you draw on, what you know about yourself and other people, and also your imagination. It's a combination of both. Sometimes it's 90% of one and 10% of the other.
Mm-hmm.
Like some of my poems are totally imagined,
mm-hmm.
and it depends at the time. But, cool. you know, I certainly find fact pretty sort of more interesting than fiction.
Right.
And I used to draw on people and mm-hmm. people's stories to write about.
To find out more about Joy 94.9, check out joy.org.au.
Joy 94.9, this is Orange Ribbon with Mark, Sam and Hugh. And our guest today is Robert King, who's the author of two very good books. And we've actually got a giveaway.
Yeah, we've got two sets of books to give away. So the first is The Wheel of Sign and the second is Selected Works by Robert J. King. The Wheel of Sign is a narrative of personal evolution, a universal and often hidden story about homosexuality and those who live their lives in the shadows. So if you'd like to win those, you need to be an existing member who hasn't won a prize in the last 2 weeks. And if you call in on 1300-JOY-949 or SMS on 0427-JOY-949 with your name and membership number.
And I have to say, we've got two sets of the books to give away. So if you call now, you can win both books.
Yes.
Excellent. And there's also another book on its way. Robert has written another book. It's not out yet, but it's going to be called Another Winter's Tale by R.J. King. And hopefully we can all read that book as well, because I really enjoyed the two books we're giving away.
Yeah, and any listeners who are interested in the books can buy them in all good bookshops, as we say.
I'm sure they could. Yes. And should. Robert, now, we've talked about one of your books and the treatment and the people that you met along the way in your life and all your travels. But one of your travels was to Bali, because you became a part owner of a cafe. Tell us, how did you get into owning a third of a cafe in Bali?
Well, this is one of my, I suppose one of my journeys about roads not taken. I was a fairly recent convert to Bali. I didn't go there till year 2000. And the first time I went there, I went with a friend and we ended up on New Year's Eve at a place called Hulu Cafe in Bali, which was owned by an Australian called Graham, who still lives in Bali. In fact, I saw him a few weeks ago. And Hulu Cafe was a place where a lot of people went because it had great drag shows. Was a fun night out. And we decided it was one of our favourite places to visit. Now, I didn't realise 4 years later that I'd actually be the owner of this bar. But one year we were holidaying in Bali, again with the same friend, and we heard that Graham wanted to sell the bar. He basically wanted to get out. Hulu had been there for nearly 20 years, and it was sort of a, one of those bars that just kept going on and on and on when all other bars were sort of failing around it, and it just kept going. It was international, and it had a great cross-section of audience, as I said, from little children to grandmothers to money boys to anyone, you know, tourists.
So, and just to clarify, this was actually a straight bar, not a gay bar or such.
So just gay friendly, is that what you'd
call it? I'd call it mixed. Yeah. Gay, very gay friendly, of course. And it was run by a gay guy anyway, so it was pretty gay friendly. Yeah. Anyway, I heard on the grapevine that the Graham was thinking of selling, and I said to my friend at the time, I said, Graham's going to sell Hulu. I wonder how much it would cost. And
Drunk were you at the time?
That's right. And then I went and had a talk to Graham, and sure enough, he was saying that he was thinking of getting out, and that no, he didn't have a buyer at the time, but if anyone was interested. And I sort of said, well, I know a friend of mine who might be interested. And one thing led to another, and basically at the end of 2004 he signed it over to us.
Okay.
So it was myself and two other friends.
Right. We'll come back to the story very soon. Joy 94.9, this is On Driven with Mark, Hugh and Sam. And we've got two winners for Robert's books that we just gave away. Anastasia from Thornbury and Damien from St. Kilda. Well done, both of you. I'm sure you'll enjoy the books. And I'm sure I will enjoy the new book when it comes out, Another Winter's Tale. And I've been told by Robert it should be coming out within the next month, roughly. So everyone look out for that as well. Now, Robert, before the music break, let's talk about the music. What was that song?
My mood swings. As I said, I think that's probably the most depressing song I've ever heard, but it's the great Peggy Lee, and I'm very curious about why she would have recorded that song, because she's known for romantic ballads about love and all that sort of stuff, but that's a nihilistic song.
I wouldn't even pick that as Peggy Lee.
Yeah, it doesn't sound like it.
No.
She must have just broken up with her boyfriend at the time.
Yeah.
Now, before the music break, we were talking about you getting involved with the Hulu Bar, or Hulu Cafe, sorry, in Bali, and you were explaining how you got into this. Now, what was it like owning a cafe that wasn't gay but did two drag shows a night? What was it like owning somewhere like that?
Look, the experience was fantastic. We moved in there and took it over, closed it down for 10 days and did a bit of renovations. It was a bit like an old faded drag queen, needed doing up.
A bit of Botox here and there.
Yeah, a bit of Botox help here and there. And so we did a few things. Didn't change the concept, because we recognised that this was a really popular place. And I found it just... I couldn't say how good it was to work with the staff. The bar staff were fantastic, and the drag queens were actually really very good too. Once you organised them and you basically told them what the rules were and that they weren't to come late, and they'd be fined if they did, and we actually had a very good time. And, you know, when it was really swinging, it was fantastic. It was crowded, there were people from everywhere, as I said before, and a lot of fun in the place. So,
About the drag queens, you told me that you actually had a drag queen strike.
Yeah, well, the drag queen strike's actually mentioned in the Selected Works book.
That's right.
I wrote a piece called The Ballad of Hulu Cafe. Yeah, we were confronted with a strike not long after we actually took over, because we decided to introduce a few strict rules because we informed the drag queens that this was an international venue and they really needed to measure up. Mm. And it was probably the top place for drag queens in the whole of Bali.
Right.
And for that reason, we decided that we have to be fairly strict about it. A, the show has to start on time. I mean, I'm an ex-school teacher, so that wasn't hard for me. So anyway, some of them didn't like this. And I remember one night after we'd had a meeting with them, my bar manager rang up and said, Rob, there's no drag queens here. In fact, they're not upstairs. No one's arrived. And we had to put on a show that night, Saturday night, which was one of our busiest nights. Mm. So I rang the entertainment manager and found out, and he rang around and found that they weren't coming to work. They decided they want more money, which is usually the thing in Indonesia, you want more money. Yeah. So what we did was we actually had to, we had a dance group who were due to perform and we had our entertainment manager. So we worked them very hard. we had one show instead of two and the show went off well. We made a lot of money. I said to my business partner, who needs drag queens? But anyway, they came back.
They came back.
Yes. Yeah.
And they realised that the new broom sweep clean was going to stick to his heels.
In the long run, the advice I was given from an ex-entertainment manager was pay them well and take no shit. So that's how we approached them from then on, and it worked very well.
Owning a business in Bali, I mean, what was the ups and downs of, I mean, for security and everything else?
A lot of people go to Bali and they see a lot of smiling faces and happy people, and that's true on the surface if you're a tourist. If you live there, you see other sides of Bali. For example, there are mafia operating in Bali, particularly in the entertainment industry and particularly mm-hmm. through the security. Mm-hmm. You have to pay money to the security people, otherwise they're likely to come in and trash the place. You have certain elements who come in and demand drinks simply because they're Balinese and they believe they have a right.
Okay.
As someone said, they think they own the country. Well, of course they do, you know. And so you've got to put up with all that stuff as well.
Mm. And did you find it easy getting used to this way of doing business?
You learn after a while that you can use corruption to your own advantage.
Okay. As long as you're clever.
As long as you're clever. But money speaks for everything over there, you know. And once you understand that, you can operate within the system.
What about you lived there for 3 years? What was it like actually living there?
The cost of living, it was about one-third of what it costs to live here. For example, we were staying in a house that we paid $3,000 a year rent, and it was furnished as well.
That's fantastic.
So food's very cheap, accommodation's very cheap. In fact, everything's pretty cheap. But I have to say Bali's actually the most expensive part of Indonesia too, because a lot of tourists go there.
Oh, the tourists,
yeah. Yeah. It's a very relaxed lifestyle. You have to actually slow down. Mm. And I often say that to people who'd go to Bali and they'd be sort of talking really fast and, you know, trying to organise seven things at once. And I said, look, if you get two things done in a day, that's okay. Yeah. That's Bali, you know.
Yeah.
So get into the rhythm of the place. Yeah.
Were you living there before you bought the bar?
I moved there about 6 months before we took over the bar. So I was actually used to, you know, some of it before I actually went in and owned the bar, yeah.
So what actually happened to the bar? I know it burnt down, but do you know why?
Well, you know, there are probably three theories. One is that commonly Bali wiring is not very good, mainly because it's done by a whole lot of different people who are not electricians. Could have been an accident. You know, somebody left a cigarette, or the worst scenario is that it could have been deliberate.
Right.
And the fact is, you never know.
Did you consider rebuilding?
For the last 2 years, I've looked to see what I can do to sort of revise Hulu, because I really think there's still a place for it in Bali. I mean, the market's pretty empty now. But it's a matter of finding the right place at the right location, and that's something I haven't been able to do yet.
Yeah.
But yeah, I'd love to do it again.
Did you? Did you ever consider where the cafe was before, you know, when it burnt down? Did you ever consider rebuilding that actual cafe?
Well, we couldn't because the lease had expired. Okay. And all the property in Bali is owned by Balinese.
Right.
So we never ever met the owner. They keep to themselves. Mm. And he didn't know who we were and we didn't know who he was. So he didn't come out of the woodwork. Mm. And we couldn't find him.
Okay.
So, you know, that's how it operates over
right,
there.
Right, right. Let's move on to your other book that you wrote, and it's Selected Works. Now, tell us what the book's about.
Oh, well, the book's basically a compilation of all of my writings over the last 15 or 20 years. There's a lot of poetry in here, plus short stories about different things.
Are they all life experiences or...?
No, some of them are totally made up, right. Imaginative. Others are taken from stories of people that I knew,
right.
A couple of life experiences, but it's a mixture, really, of right. everything.
You've got the Hulu Cafe. Now, you explained this to me before the show. I thought it was the drag queens that was actually saying this during the show, but it was actually the drinks, wasn't it? Tell us, read a little bit.
Yeah. Okay. What I've tried to do with this, and probably this is one of the hardest pieces I had to write, because I was trying to recreate the atmosphere in the bar. I used Lou Reed as a bit of inspiration, because when I'm talking about the drag queens, I tried to get the rhythm of Walk on the Wild Side
right.
into
right.
this. Hard rhythm, actually. Mm. But anyway, it starts off like Hulu Cafe used to start off. We'd play Cabaret, you know, the Joel Grey
yep.
version of Cabaret. So people would come in and they'd hear, "Willkommen, good evening, ladies and gentlemen. So nice to see you again. This way, we have a table. Would you like a drink? Let me repeat that. Dua bintang kecil, satu pink puff, dan satu screaming orgasm. Coming right up. Here you are. I'll just put this coaster here. For you, sir, madam. Popcorn, in cabaret, in cabaret, in cabaret, singing. Here are Fran, Jan and Shan, son's husbands. Will you have a screaming orgasm? Vodka, Bailey's, coffee liqueur and whipped cream. Here are the tattooed trailer trash from Darwin. Doug and Bruce and Sel, thighs overlap their seats. And for you, sir, a blowjob. Banana liqueur, coffee liqueur and whipped cream. Fran's Hans and Vera with a Johnny Walker red label and three glasses perched on high stools at the bar. Are you into a Hulu drag queen? Gin, vodka, Galliano, pineapple, orange and lime juice. Simone, Elaine, Marianne, Orang Francis, virgins to the sacrifice displayed under the whirling fan. Sven and Kos, Luke and Miriam, Antonio and friends, Kohei and friends, Mickey and friends. Tonight, why not share an illusion. Vodka, melon liqueur, coconut liqueur, triple sex, lime juice. Those are drinks, by the way, from the bar.
These were drinks from the bar. Now, on the next page, and I think this is fairly important, and I'm sure you wanted to mention it, you've written a poem for your partner. It's on page 49.
Yeah. I have to preview this by talking about my partner. My partner Didi comes from Aceh in Indonesia, and I first met him in Bali. I hate to use the word victim, but he's a survivor of the tsunami of 2004, and he arrived in Bali in 2005 when I met him. So I actually wrote this poem. It's called Dari Aceh Dan Cinta, which means from Aceh with love. A great wave washed you to my place. On that beach in the water, I stood and tried to see the wave that crashed and tore life on that Sunday morning. A bundle of clothes caught in some sticks, a pink thong, it funneled to your city between the green mountains. Roads potholed, piles of shells in streets, a ship sits on a house, detritus strewn far, earth, sea, power, dashed humanity in minutes. You floated to my shore, sticking like a limpet on my world-weary bed. I don't want you. I don't want to stick. I want to float. Dari Aceh, you said. and I recalled your smile willed me to bend. I wanted your story, your tale of events, your recall of dead friends. Later, much later, you began to talk. Faces emerged from the swill, eyes white with death, limbs loose, and bloated corpses floated by. You were there, you saw. Your soft eyes deepened, an impish smile, your body danced with friendly charm, your sweetness within hooked into me. Not again. Been there, done that, I said, as your wave washed over me. I struggled and edged towards the depths. I let you in, and now you are here. We stick.
Very nice.
Beautiful.
It's a nice way to end the show, and fortunately we've come to the end of the show, Robert. But thank you very much for coming in today, and I'm sure these books are really worth getting a hold of and reading them. So if you do, you'll enjoy it. And thank you, Robert. Have you enjoyed your afternoon with us?
I've enjoyed it very much. Thank you for having me.
Thank you. And just to recap, the poem that Robert just read was a poem he wrote for his partner, Didi. So well done. That's Orange Ribbon for another week. Our thanks to Robert for taking time out to chat to us today. Coming up next on Joy is the Women's Zone with the wonderful Kaz Mitchell, who's just been waving to me through the window. Thanks for joining us. And Mark, Sam and myself will be back again next week at 2 p.m. Saturday afternoon with more insights into the LGBTIQ community here in Australia and around the world. So thank you for joining us. Bye-bye.
Thank you. Bye.
Thanks for listening to a Joycast from Joy 94.9.
Thanks for listening to another Joy podcast brought to you by Australia's LGBTQIA+ community media organisation, Joy. Help keep Joy on air. Head to joy.org.au. Joy, a diverse sound for a diverse community.